This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. My name is Peter Higgins and you can find me at Conkers3 on Twitter. And I'm here with my good colleague Peter at Wheelie Dealer on Twitter. Pete, how you doing?
Yeah, mate, yeah. Same old story, but, you know, we're plodding on.
Okie dokie. Same old story, different day, as they say in the business.
Yeah.
Okie dokie. Pete, we have got a guest with us today.
Oh, wow.
And I'm looking forward to introducing that person a bit later on. And we like to keep things interesting on this podcast. So I spoke with this, I almost called him a young man then, but he's not. He's probably the same age as me, so he's an old man.
It was young once, yeah.
So he'll be on the show with us in about 10, 15 minutes. And I'm hoping what he has to share with us regarding his insight and his view of the markets and his way of attacking and profiting from the markets will enhance all of your learning. So we'll look forward to that in a little while. But first, Pete, I wanted to talk about the markets because it's been a little bit volatile. And once again, on a Monday, people have taken a sharp intake of breath with the markets dropping, but it's still sitting on that sort of trading range and it's bouncing around the 7,000 and the 4,000 on the all share. And today it's had a pop, you know, up a little bit today. So what's your thoughts of it all?
Well, do you know, it's funny because it's been a bit frustrating for me because I'm quite heavily hedged on my portfolio in that, you know, I've held on to all of the stocks I had going into this kind of wobble. You know, as we discussed on the podcast, I mean, we could see that some sort of wobble was obviously coming. And I got myself pretty well hedged. But the frustrating thing is that hedge hasn't really worked because what has actually happened is because energy prices have done so well and because commodities have done quite well in some cases such as coal and whatever, because obviously coal is really energy, because of that, being short on the FTSE 100 hasn't really got me anywhere. I mean, basically it's pretty much stayed, you know, where it is. It's like some days I'm gaining a bit on it, other days I'm losing a bit, and it's pretty much just stayed where it is. I actually added a small short on the S&P 500 the other day, and that helped me a lot, obviously, on yesterday, wasn't it, Monday, because we're recording this on Tuesday, the 5th of October.
Yep. We're a day early. Why are we a day early, by the way? Where are you going tomorrow?
Oh, I'm popping up to see Mark Bentley tomorrow.
Ah, okie dokie.
At Marban 100, so, right. So he's moving up north, so I'm taking this opportunity to dive up to Luton and catch him before he moves up there. So
cool. Well, hello there, Mark Bentley, Marban 100. Hello there.
So I've been a bit frustrated by that, but the handy thing for me is I'd actually built up quite a nice buffer of profit. So even though I've taken quite a kick in, and last week I had my portfolio was down 5%, which was flipping painful, but that was really down to a couple of stocks misbehaving, which we might talk about later. But, you know, I'm still doing okay on the year and I'm pretty happy with how things are going, really. So I'm sort of relaxed about it, but just a little bit frustrated. I think in the future I will think more about shorting on the FTSE 250 because I just think that'd be a better match to my portfolio. But it has the disadvantage that you can only put the short on and take the short off during trading hours. And it needs a bit more margin when you do it as a spread bet. But, you know, as I say, I mean, I think the FTSE 100 seems to be sideways. The FTSE 250 has come off quite a bit, and so have the smaller indexes like the AIM and the FTSE all, the FTSE small cap. The US markets have taken quite a hit with the Nasdaq dropping heavily, obviously. As you say, they're bouncing back today. I'm not convinced this is necessarily the end of the wobble, and I think we could still have a few weeks of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things I wanted to say, Pete. There's a consideration to be had, given the volatility in markets, in some people saying, you know, don't edge. You know, you don't know which direction the market's going to go in. I feel that we're going to have a volatile October. But historically, if you go back 50 years, October's actually been a month that's positive for markets. But, you know, over 50 years, have we had, you know, the inflation risk? Have we had, you know, commodity prices going up? Have energy prices going up? You know, lots of firms not being able to have jobs, but haven't got enough workers to do the jobs, you know. And, you know, all the other stuff that's going on regarding, you know, national insurance and all the other taxation stuff that's coming looming large. So I don't know what October brings, but that little number of 7,000 on the FTSE 100 and 4,000 on the All Share just seems to be there, just testing and touching and testing and touching and testing and touching. And at some point, if that gives, we could have an ugly October. If it doesn't give and the markets do rally, and the debt ceiling issues addressed in the US, the markets could ride higher, mate. You know what I mean? Just don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good way. I mean, the way I tend to look at it, because I'm very simplistic with everything, is that as far as I have experienced in my, you know, few years of investing, it only seems to me that we get really big crashes when there is a recession. I don't think we're going into recession. I think the recovery is going to be more patchy and more slower and more struggling than a lot of people hope for. But I don't think we're going to go into recession. And as such, I think that this pullback is literally a pullback, a correction, you know, maybe a 10% drop or whatever it is. Yeah. But I just don't think we're going into a full-on recession. I mean, it would be pretty much unheard of to have a big recession, then to come out of it for 2 minutes and then to go into a big recession again. I don't think that's happened very often in history, if it's ever happened.
I don't think it's happened before in history, Pete, but I think that adage of it's, you know, it's never going to happen again, or things doesn't happen twice, or blah, 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 it's different this time, is a dangerous thing to actually, you know, precedent things with. I think, unfortunately, we are in lots of different predicaments here, and there's so many different forces that are negative at the present time. It's just like, how many things could you have, you know? And markets have done it before so many times, Pete. They climb this wall of worry, and you're going, this has got to be the top. This has got to be the top, and the top gets higher, and it goes higher, and it goes higher, and it goes higher, and then when you're least expecting it, the markets go whoosh. You know, and we've seen that last March. It's like everyone was talking about this, that, and the other. Didn't expect the markets to go the way it did. Wallop. You know, we had it a few years before that. The Brexit vote. Wallop. No one expecting the markets to collapse like that, and it did, and it returned. And I think what's happened over the past, and I keep going back to 2007-08, is that recent investors and people that have been in the market since 2015, 2014, or whatever, past 10 years, haven't really experienced a long-term market decline, which then has not recovered. So the expectation is that whatever happens, the market's going to recover anyway. It's going to be fine, blah, 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 blah. And as it has been proven over the course of the long-term of the markets, markets have been a good vehicle to be in long-term, you know, but occasionally it has that period where for 5-10 years where it goes absolutely nowhere. And we've got some stocks in the market, you know, I was speaking to fund manager today, calls it dinosaurs. They've gone nowhere for 20 years, Pete. So you've got to choose the right stocks that even with dividends, they've gone absolutely nowhere. You know, so you have to be mindful of that.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I mean, it's interesting. You talk about the factors that are negatives on the market, you know, things like the US debt ceiling and the fact that Biden can't get his infrastructure bill through, the fact that you've still got COVID hanging around, you've got supply problems, you've got inflation worries, you've got potential for central banks to raise rates. I mean, the big one for me is just the sheer overvaluation that we're seeing. And we've talked about this many times on the podcast. And I mean, so a classic example, and this is particularly, you know, the NASDAQ and stuff, which I just think in part is absolutely ridiculous. But we're seeing it on our stocks as well. But One of the great hilarious ones is I've got to do a thank you to our mate Henry for this one, and it's a classic. He showed me Mr. Gox the other day. That's Mr. G-O-X-X, and he's the crypto hamster trading hamster thing. And this hamster, he's on Twitter as Mr. Gox, and this this crypto hamster has outperformed loads of human traders, which I just I just love that. I just think that is just, but it's such a great sign at the top of the market, and it's something me and you discussed yesterday, I think it was, where we said you can tell it's a toppy market because every private investor's got their own website.
Yeah, everybody wants to blog. Everyone's got a podcast. So yeah, it's a sign, mate. It could be a sign. It could be a case of everyone's learning and wants to share that information as well, Pete. You know, which is
well,
good.
Yeah, because, no, I'm sure.
You know, the bigger the community, the better the community, I would say. You know, bar a few people that are using it for ulterior motives. So yeah, you know, it's an interesting time, Pete. It certainly is.
I mean, what I'm doing in terms of, you know, you were saying that, you know, it could be that the markets go higher. The good thing for me is I'm pretty much 100% invested in terms of my long positions. I've got a bit of cash kicking around, so that's good. But I'm hedged, you know, around, I think I'm hedged about 45% now, something like that. And it's on my website. And the good thing is that if the markets do rally, I've always got my stop losses, which I'm really disciplined with these days because I learned my lesson a few years ago. And I'm sure Jason will talk about stop losses. Jason, who's Jason?
I don't know. Yeah, I was just going to say, who's Jason?
Yeah, I don't know who Jason is.
Move on, Peter. Come on.
No idea who I'm talking about now or why I brought that name up. But anyway, that's how it goes. But so I've got stop losses. But the other thing is, I'm very driven by that 1321 EMA. If we get a bull cross on that EMA, that's a big signal that I need to be taking my hedges off. So, you know, I'm pretty relaxed how things are going at the moment. Let's just see what happens.
Okie dokie. On that note, Pete, we're going to talk more markets in the next segment, but I'm going to bring out our guest.
That's a good idea. I wonder who it is.
Yeah, you know who it is, but I'm going to introduce it to the other people here now that are listening. And again, with regards to all of our listeners, wherever you are in the world, thank you ever so much for coming back to this podcast, number 59. And our guest that we brought for you today is a guy who's been a full-time risk manager of his monies for some time. He's one of the people that I go to regarding charting. He makes a living from it. He does it. He's open. He's candid. He's objective. And most of all, he's trying to help and educate other people via his trading bases platform. And on that note, I'll bring you Jace or Jason, and you can find him on Twitter at StealthServe, and he's one to follow, and he's probably one to consider subscribing to his website. Jace, how you doing, fella?
Hey, good, thanks. Cheers for having us on.
You're very welcome, mate, and I'm glad we've got you away from fixing your van, which you always seem to be fixing these days.
Oh, well, fixing or converting.
Right, okay. Mate, first of all, before we get into the nuances of the markets, which you're going to help us analyse a little bit and talk a bit about markets, just tell people a little bit about yourself and what you've been doing and how long you've been doing it for, please.
So I'm basically, these days, I'm a stubborn trend follower of small to mid-cap growth stocks, UK mainly. And I'm a swing trader of more efficient main market stocks, be it US or UK. And I suppose my third time frame is, yeah, you know, I dollar cost average a pension as well. That's the sort of lanes I sort of move in. So I do a bit of everything. I do a bit of what you do in the background, and I do a bit of active stuff. And in between, I'm just a stubborn trend follower of growth stocks.
Cool. So with that, Jace, for those uninitiated amongst us, could you expand on what a trend trader follower is?
So basically, you know, I filter down into growth trends. So, you know, I want to ride the best growth I can find in the market at this point in time. And I want to basically get on board when it triggers my time frame it will be a breakout. The first signal will always be a breakout. When it triggers my time frame, it's rising over my time frame, my look back period. You could say 200 days. You could say 6 months, but I have my own period. And once it basically initiates its trend, that for me is where the best reward to risk exists. So, in a recovery stock, you was talking previously about some stocks just go to sleep and they do nothing. For that stock to come alive again, it's probably going to bump its head through 52-week highs and it's going to stay there. There will be whipsaws. Yeah. But the reality is I'm not looking for big efficient main market stocks to come back to life. They tend to do the big moves early in the life of the company. So I'm going to be looking for small to mid-cap stocks. I'm going to be screening down. I'm going to be weighting my portfolio towards the ones that have actual growth. I don't mean just stories of growth. I want to see growth in the numbers. I want to see year on year, quarter on quarter, or half on half, be it an AIM stock. And
Jace, you're talking there, so like revenue growth, profit growth, that kind of thing, are you?
Yeah, earnings per share. I want to see acceleration in those. I want to see I call it gas in the tank. So yeah. I basically look at the whole market every day and I rank the whole market by the, ticks the most boxes for growth. Purely looking for the strongest numbers, and that's my game, And me and you are both in WATR. That kind of stock is the kind of stock I like to ride.
Yeah.
Illiquid. I don't mind widespreads. I'm not shooting for 20% moves. I'm shooting for 200, 300, or the moon. Not got there yet, but I'll keep trying. But that's my, 60, 70% of my portfolio is always geared towards that. Recently,
Jace, how many stocks would you hold in that kind of part of your portfolio?
So it always comes down to position sizing. Cheaper stocks tend to have smaller positions when it comes to position sizing. And if the market's good for that kind of, say the 20p to £2 sort of area, you could probably get up to maybe 16, 18 stocks full positions. But the reality is the portfolio will, say I buy my starter position and then I get to add to it. As you know, I only add to things what have follow on signals for me. So the ones what let me add will build into core positions. I'm happy with actually building a 4% on entry, 3 to 5% on entry, and then sort of 7 to 10% on the second entry. It usually ends up around 6 to 8%. I get in a stock myself, and then price appreciation can send that anywhere. So. In reality,
I really like that because I like the idea that you are sort of choosing the stocks on the growth in the numbers and the accelerate and all that kind of stuff, and you're using the market to tell you what to do. So when it breaks out of your first base, your sideways move, it breaks out higher. That's your first signal to buy the position, whatever, and then you let it run up and then it does another sort of sideways move and you're waiting for it to give another signal, at which point you'll buy more. And I just love the idea. I love the fact that you're letting the market tell you what to do.
Yeah, I mean, that is the core of it. And the reality is that by doing it that way, it still fights against, your psychology, buying these things sometimes. You think this could just whipsaw me and I'll be out for a scratch or whatever. But the reality is, you know, it weights your portfolio in what's working.
Yeah.
And the ones that aren't working, they might just be half positions and you'll get stopped out. They tend to have more room until they start trending strongly, because when they start trending strongly, the price action, you know, lets you sort of trail tighter sometimes. They tend to be quite loose in a stage one area base. But as they start to trend smoothly, think about Boohoo on its journey, that the consolidation's got tighter on the run up, you know.
Yeah.
But so some stocks just won't let you add to them, and you'll get stopped out, or you'll stop it out yourself just to move into something else, or you might have to stop something to add to something what's giving you an add point. So you're always weighted in the best of what's working in your portfolio.
I think that's a good point, Jason. And the thing that I like about the technique that you've been using for some time profitably is that you always talk about position sizing, and then you've got your 1R in the sense of the risk amount per share that you're actually given as a quota for that particular stock. So can you, in your own words, can you explain the 1R that you're using each time regarding your risk weighting and position sizing, please?
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
Yeah, there's a few parts what have to go together here. So everyone's seen the kind of the risk sheet where it says if you lose 10%, you've got to make 11% to get back to break even. If you lose 50%, you've got to make 100%.
Yeah.
So I never risk more than 10% of my portfolio at stop loss.
Yep.
So when I come at a position, obviously Pete knows what I'm doing. He knows what a base is. I'm wrong under that base. If I go any tighter than that, I will call it kind of the aggressive side of the base. But the initial risk will be a percent of my portfolio. Now, this is going to be personal to everyone. For me, I'm happy with 1% risk. That means I can...
Sorry, Jace, just to be clear then. So in terms of what you're talking about as a base, so let's say the share has jumped up. It's then been wiggling sideways for a while, maybe for a couple of weeks or whatever. And that is the base forming. And what you're saying is, as it breaks higher again, you might add to that position, but your stop loss will have been moved up and your stop loss will be just below that wiggling range. So that's like just below the base. Is that right?
Yeah. I always say I'm long and I'm wrong. You know, I'm long above, I'm wrong below. And anything in between is noise.
Yeah.
So basically, I will risk a percent of my portfolio. Initial risk is always calculated in R. So I risk 1%, so we count that as 1R. Now, that 1% is basically 1% of my portfolio. So I'm not just buying 5% of my portfolio in something evenly. It's going to be different on every stock. Every stock's going to have a different weighting in the portfolio because it's reverse engineered for the volatility of the actual product I trade. So some will have less lower weightings. More volatile, cheaper stocks will naturally have more lower weightings. Higher beta, efficient main market stocks, they will have a lot higher weightings. It is what it is, you know.
I fully understand that, Jace. It's no different to an ordinary investor putting a larger percentage of the portfolio in a blue chip stock, and the lower percentage, hopefully, in an AIM stock that's a punt, a bit of a risky stock.
But
yeah, I'm fully understand that.
There is a big but here, because on a risk-per-risk basis, the cheap blue sky AIM stock might have 1%, say 2% of your portfolio in it. And say it halves in price overnight, it takes you for 1% of the portfolio. Now, the blue chip, you might have 6-8% in, it halves overnight on something terrible. So risk per risk, it's the risk is lower in the stock what's got the riskier fundamentals.
Yes,
if you know
indeed.
What I mean.
Yes.
And that is, you know, so I tend to shy away from these big main market stocks. I want to get price appreciation through sort of growth percent moves, and basically some stocks I call them sloths, so we call them sloths. Yeah. You know, the kind of stocks what are a little bit boring. They have a very tight price action, REITs and stuff like that, but they could be higher priced. They don't benefit sort of well from that this style, really, because the gap risk is a little bit higher on them. So risk per risk, cheaper stocks, lighter weightings, more volatile, bigger percent trends. You know, and at the end of the day, it's just multiples of risk. So R is basically you risk one to make two or more. You know, that's how it's measured. But back to the beginning is that 10% I risk of the actual portfolio insulates me from ever having to trade out of a hole, because the maximum I can have on is 10 trades at 1% risk, 20 trades at 0.5% risk. In reality, it will be basically the ones what progress will get the full positions, things. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What's working? So it will never be kind of an even weighted portfolio. I always say weighting should be earned. You can't just split your portfolio 10 ways and throw it in the market. You'll get killed by volatility. So you have to sort of embrace the volatility in a sensible way. And that's how I do it.
I really like that. Jace, you were talking there about, you know, sort of a relationship between the amount of risk you're taking and the size of the stock, depending on volatility. Is there a simple way you can explain that, or is it actually quite a sophisticated model you've got for working that out?
It's called fixed fractional position sizing. And basically, you basically work out your risk. So if you've got a £100,000 account, 1% risk will be 1,000 risk, and you will basically calculate. So if my stops hit underneath that base, it will cost 1% of account. And basically you take off your entry minus exit, and do you get how many points there is there, and you basically divide your risk by it, or divide.
So in a way, it's like the sort of the sort of range of the sideways movement that's forming the base is a key factor in that, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, because the price action of that base or consolidation is the volatility of that stock.
Yeah,
that is the stock's all news. All opinions, everything is baked into that consolidation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if it makes a move greater than that consolidation, that means that something is wrong. And, you know, the market should not trade more than that, you know, against you.
Yeah, that's good.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I think going back, just for layman's terms, going back to explaining what the 1R is and trying to work out what 1% is, essentially, whatever the portfolio is at the beginning or prior to the investment, you're looking at a £100,000 portfolio. 1% of that, to risk 1%, would mean that you're exposing £1,000 to that particular trade.
Correct.
And that's how you work it out. And each time you're looking at 1R, another R, another R. If you get to 3R, you're looking at £3,000 being at risk at your portfolio. And that's the way to look at it. And that goes back to the importance of position sizing or there or thereabouts.
You would never do that, though. Your risk should stay consistent. So this is where people kind of get a bit caught up with this. You know, you shouldn't have to risk more than 1%. Sometimes I do. I go on the gas sometimes, WATR being a prime example. But I've got 10% heat or 10% risk to play with. And at the time WATR sort of broke out, you know, I had one fantastic idea and one average idea. And I threw 2% risk on WATR because it was a fantastic idea. It was, it would have been the same risk to the account, but I just put it in one stock instead of two. So, but you've got to be consistent in your risk. So when we talk about compounding, you know, for my pension, I'm dollar cost averaging over time, you know, compounding, that's one thing. But when you're trying to make money out of stocks, growth stocks for price appreciation, the compounding is basically every time I close a winner, say the account goes to 200,000, well, that 1% risk will be 2,000. Every time I close a trade, if it's a winner, it compounds. The new base risk of the account will be 1% of that closed balance. So if the account goes down, I'll be risking less than 1,000. If the account goes up, I'll be risking more. The beauty of it is I will always be 100 trades away from blowing that account. I cannot blow the account. It's impossible.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I like that.
Because as the account goes smaller, your 1% gets smaller, you will continue to be 100 trades away at all times. So, you know, as the account grows bigger, the only way you can blow it is if you overheat the account. So if you let the market take more than 10% away from you on that base balance. So when it came to the market crash, you know, open gains, you know, I don't count chickens before they've hatched. So open gains are some that they belong to the trend, but the closed balance is the important thing for me. And I also run a trend model. So, you know, that 10%, if the trend model's reading 50% bullish, that 10% goes down to 5%. It's like a clockwork mechanism. So,
sorry, Jace, I didn't get that bit. What's the trend level? I didn't understand that.
So I run like an index trend model, a market model, what tells me how bullish the market is. So, yeah. So 0 to 100%. So if it's 100% bullish, I'm risking a maximum of 10% of my account heat, meaning I could take 10 trades at 1%. Now, if the market is 50% bullish, I'm risking a maximum of 5%.
Wow. How do you work that out? How's that calculated, that thing?
Price levels and moving averages.
Okay.
So, you know, moving averages being probably the best way to do it. You could simply say, some people just use the 200-day and just say, is the 200-day rising or falling, and is price above the 200-day or below it? And,
so it's a fairly simple thing. You're using fairly simple things to identify how strong the market is.
The good thing about moving averages is, you know, if the 200-day is rising, the trend is up over 200 days.
Yeah.
If the 400 days rising, and they don't lie. They calculate every day and they never lie. So it doesn't really matter that much where price is regarding that. But I do it over, I always say one market does not make a trend. So I do it over the US and the UK markets, and I throw the DAX in the mix as well. So, yeah. You know, I get a reading off 9 markets. You know, I do it on a weekly basis. It doesn't change much. You know, it's primary trends, slower moving. So it's people always ask me, well, how do you not get knocked out on every correction? Well, I'm trading outside the noise. I'm outside of the volatility on all my stocks. And, you know, I, as a trend follower, I have to sit through every correction until the market takes me out.
So during, like, a big heavy drop in the markets, you still just obey your stop losses?
Well, a heavy drop in the markets, the trend model will take me out.
And right, stop loss. Okay. Yeah.
So I might get stopped out. I'll be... And when you get to a bad area in the market, you're usually running some good profits as well. So you usually compound... When you get stopped out, the risk goes up on the account usually after you get stopped out.
Because you've locked in a load of the unrealized gain. Yeah, I get you. Yeah.
Now, the thing with the market crash was we'd had that correction. It's a curve fitter's dream, the periods we've had in the market recently. Well, not recently, but I kind of remember 2014, 15. I remember 2010, 11. Kind of where the market just it went up and it came back down. Lots of whipsaws.
Yeah.
But, you know, being a stubborn trend follower, and I want to catch those outliers. You know, I've had money in the markets. You know, I rode into the financial crash. I rode into the tech bubble with money in funds as well, and I got out. You know, what I found in the market crash, it came quite soon after that deep correction we had. Was it end of 2018? We had quite a deep correction.
Yeah, we had like a period of choppiness, didn't we?
Then the market basically, it was good to us, and then it took about 20% off me and 2% of the portfolio as well. So I only went 2% into draw, maybe 3% at maximum into drawdown in the market crash. And it was a mixture of being stopped out of a few. I had a very lucky rebalance, I did. And also the trend model. The trend model doesn't really blink. At the moment, the trend model's, you know, really bullish still. It doesn't blink on a normal correction like we're in. But when the market drops off and starts really trading levels it shouldn't be trading, it drops fast. And that took me out of the market. So I came in after the crash. And being a trend follower who buys breakouts of bases, most people seem to be raising cash, and I'd only just started buying, so
you were hoovering it up. Yeah,
but like I say, it you know, the curve fitter's dream in the market. If you'd sat through it, tried to stubbornly ride trends, and you got chopped up in 2014, you'd miss 2012-13, which were fantastic in small caps. And I remember Trifast and Michelmersh and AMS and all those stocks we rode in that period. And, you know, nobody believed, you know, it's always a wall of worry, as Conkers was saying. It's always a wall of worry. You're always going to be doing exactly the opposite of what everyone else is talking about. And I'm pretty, you know, the FTSE and that was going sideways, and it took us some time to get loaded into those trades. And then the market left. So choppy markets kind of, you know, it makes people think that markets can't trend, but in reality they can trend for 3, 4, 5 years just because we had a horrible sort of range bound sort of market for quite some time.
I think Jace, what's been happening though regarding the markets and individuals in the markets, I think there are a lot of you're talking now going back to 2014. I think a lot of investors have only been in the markets for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and what they've experienced, unfortunately, has been the Brexit vote, the recent crash on the markets as well, last March, when the markets just went, you know, Pete Tong again, and they've had those two. And I think a lot of investors are very, very nervous, and this is why, you know, on here, I'm always banging on about psychology and thinking about and getting yourself resilient enough to deal with the markets. And as you say, trends can run for a long time. We, you know, Pete and I have spoken on the last two podcasts, and the Monday before this podcast and the podcast before, the markets have had a wobble on that Monday. And there's so many people saying, I'm all cash. I've sold. And, you know, I was buying yesterday some stock, and people going, oh, I've been panicking all day and you're there buying. Why are you buying? I'm going, because it's now fallen into the area that I think is I'm comfortable with buying some more, you know, and it's not suitable for everybody else. Some people want to sell, let them sell. But I think there's there's more of a nervousness because people have not experienced periods of time where the markets haven't gone their way. And they've experienced the likes of BOTB crashing out of the sky, and they're looking at their stock and going, it could be mine next, you know.
Yeah. Coming out of the Brexit vote, you know, it was exactly the same, wasn't it? 16 and 17 were fantastic, but everyone was too scared.
Yeah.
And it's always going to be like that. I always say, you know, doing the right thing never feels good. No one's going to agree with you. I never go to the pub and talk about, I don't talk about trading with anyone who's not in the markets. It's not a very good subject, you know. You have to go through all the same old stuff, buy low, sell high. Really. And then you know, it's never going to feel good. And you know, I always say the market's bottom where you know, basically when you start get those knots in your stomach and you go, oh, maybe this is the time. And that's always when they do put the bottom in. And
yeah, it's that capitulation thing, isn't it? When there's like maximum fear and everyone's absolutely had enough.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you get desensitized to it over the years. I mean, I had money flying. I remember adding to a tech fund just before the tech bubble popped. So, you know, I lost money on that side of the equation. But, you know, I rode it for many years on the way up to that. The GFC, I come from an investing family and my dad got us out. I was going away anyway. I had plans, so it was easy for me to take the money out. And my dad got out right at the top. Just amazing how he did it. And it was my dad who rebalanced just before the market crash as well, because I run my dad's account as well. So he rebalanced his half of the account. And that was quite an amazing call as well.
Yeah. Does your dad do similar to you do with the sort of like Mark Minervini kind of concepts and whatever?
No, I mean, I don't really do the Mark Minervini myself. I kind of, you know, I don't think anyone could trade the Mark Minervini way in UK AIM stocks. I'd love Mark Minervini to do a book on how he used to trade illiquid small cap US stocks back in the day, because that's where he made his big moves forward, wasn't it? But no, he doesn't trade those anymore. Like the Zangers of this world and that, they can't trade these stocks anymore because...
Yeah. They're too big. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I trade wider primary trend. You know, I'm not a momentum trader like Minervini, who buys, you know, the strongest, biggest stocks as they're breaking out for a 10, 15, 20% move. No, I'm going for 200, 300% move on this time frame.
Yeah.
It's very different, isn't it? Very different.
So how did you... come to designing your system?
Well, you're talking about my dad. You know, we butt heads on this kind of stuff. My dad got an app for his phone and he used to come back from work and go, oh, gold's down today, isn't it? And I look at the chart, gold's up, you know. It's like everything was, you know, we totally butt heads with this stuff. But, you know, he's got great market sense, and my granddad before him as well. But you know, I just basically dug in and I had to learn to trade actively because, and I'm not active, you know, I'm only active when I'm swing trading or doing some intraday stuff. But the core of what I do is end of day, so people can sort of come to the screens on the evening, actionable for the morning, without looking at level two or intraday charts or anything like that. Don't need any of it for what I do on the, you know, the main sort of primary trend. But yeah, we kind of butt heads, very, very different sort of styles. And in the end, my results were outshining sort of in this area. So my dad just said, right, you just trade that side, I'll trade my fund side. and that's how it went.
Often a good move. So Jace, I mean, yeah, what you've sort of just outlined is really the sort of trading basis concept and pyramiding up and stuff like that. I mean, your returns last year were utterly stunning. What was it, 110% or something?
If I worked out on the tax year, yeah, it was quite a bit over 100%, yeah.
Yeah, incredible.
It's insane. It sounds embarrassing, but... Going full circle, you've got to remember I bullheadedly add to the best positions I'm riding, and you know the risk is always in check, and I keep attacking those trends, and when that market comes around where everyone questions and they don't believe markets can trend anymore, I'm the person who makes money from that.
Yes, yeah.
and it came around in sort of 2012-13. It came round in 2016-17. It came round again. So, you know, I gave back 20% or whatever into the market crash of open profits. And I went 2 to 3% into drawdown. I was swing trading US stocks straight away off the bottom. Zoom and stuff like that were really obvious strong stocks. We didn't know why, but the market knew why. You know, go figure.
Yeah.
And then it ended up, you know, gambling stocks, medical stocks, and WATR being one, Ergo being one, CER, all these fantastic stocks. CER being a classic case of, you know, it showed its hand before the market crashed, and it just pulled back into the base as the market crashed, and that was, and I didn't get on that one. I got on a little bit later, but you know.
Jace, it's really interesting you touched on there. You're adding to the winners as they're climbing, and you're following the trend, and you're adding on to the trend, which is why your profits accelerated. There's a big debate ongoing constantly, almost every week now, about averaging up and averaging down. I don't get the impression that you average down when something starts to roll over. You're saying it's exhausted. It's momentum, so therefore you're probably looking to close the position. Just talk to me about the averaging upside of it and then the averaging downside of it.
First things first, I'm trying to get my position on in the early stages of the trend.
Absolutely.
And then I will just say it's in trend mode. I've got my weighting, so I'm not going to just keep adding and, you know, adding and adding until. So that's a point. You know, you've got to be conscious of where you are in this trend. So when you come to the fever trees and the boos and the gores, you know, trying to get on them late, you've just got to, I always say, you know, Mo Farah's just ran a marathon and you're asking him to run it again. You just got to realize that you've missed it. The institutions, you can see the institutional footprint in those stocks. Even if they don't break trend, they've got to lower their weightings and move into other things, haven't they? So that's one thing. Be conscious of where you are in the big picture trend.
Jace, in that, am I right in thinking that a typical stock that is broken out of the lowest base and is moving up is probably only going to do, what, four or five consolidation, you know, four or five bases on the way up? Is that roughly right?
Yeah, I think William O'Neill sort of says you get to a stage five, it's usually the end of the trend. But, you know, we trade for outliers, don't we? So when you do get a fever tree or a gore or a boo or a CER or you know, Trifast, you know, and you start seeing seven or eight bait, they turn into outlier status, and they're the ones what make the big gains, aren't they? You only have to catch one or two, but that's where the bulk of your profit will come from, you know?
I guess the point is that if you're buying into something fresh that has already done five consolidation periods, five bases or six bases, you're coming in late, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, hang on a minute. I didn't buy it there. Because I see every setup all the way up.
Yeah.
At the time, I might just have no money to put in it, but I just have to stand aside and just, you know, I'm after. There will be no trend to see when I am buying.
Yeah.
This is what you've got to remember. The maximum reward to risk, you won't see a trend, but you'll see a signal.
Yeah, because what you'll have done is you'll have seen the sideways move down at the bottom. You'll have seen the sideways move for quite a long time. Then it breaks out higher, and that's your signal to start buying off of the first base.
Yeah, exactly. So moving to Conker's sort of question about averaging up, averaging down, and I will just throw one in the mix, averaging in, because, you know, I suppose dollar cost averaging is basically a way of averaging in it over time, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, averaging in, you get your, say your risk is 3% of account, you buy 1% this month, 1% next month, 1% the month after, no matter what the price. Now, that would be averaging in. The risk is totally in check. You know how much your risk, how much your weighting has got to be. Very sensible. Averaging up. I've got a little bit of a, you know, this is a little challenge for anyone to sort of do at weekend. If people could write this down and just drop it in a spreadsheet or something and get it in their heads, it might be an interesting little thing for them to do. I did it for the members at TV last week. So say you've got an entry on a stock at £1, and if you put 3% of your portfolio in that stock, and then it goes up 100%, and you put another 3% of your portfolio in that stock at £2.
Yeah.
And then the other trade will be you put 3% of your portfolio in the stock at £1, the same.
Yeah.
And it halves in price to 50p, and you put another 3% of your portfolio in that stock. So the averaging down, the second one will give you 9,000 shares on a 100,000 account. The averaging up, 100% up, will give you 4,500 shares. Now, what happens if the day after you bought those shares, the share price halves on a profit warning?
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer via ShareePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPEETS. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe to ShareePad today using the TWINPEETS promo code, and you can save up to £69. Visit sharescope.co.uk/sharepad for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
The averaged up, the one you bought at the higher price, do you think that's more risky? Obviously, it's dead obvious what the answer is going to be here. Or the one we're averaged down.
Yeah.
So the one we're averaged down, 50% profit warning, you're going to lose 3.7% of the 3.75% of the portfolio overnight.
Yeah.
The one you bought 100% higher, you're going to lose less than half of that. You're going to lose 1.5% of the portfolio overnight.
Yeah.
So it exponentially gets less risky at the higher price, and it exponentially gets more risky at the lower price. Because you've got a huge weighting in something. There's two things going on here. You know, it's the weighting in something what's not working in your account. It's now got double the vol in a losing position. Now, the averaging up has got double the vol, but it's in a winning position. So every up and down tick, you know, it's in profit until that profit warning comes out. Obviously, it has its limitations.
The important thing there, Jace, is that, and this is what happens with a lot of people, is that, and, you know, I've been at fault for that, and I can speak about an example I've just done regarding it in a minute, is that I think a lot of people suffer from loss aversion. That's what it's about. So the share price goes up, and they add to it, probably, or they don't because it's winning, so they don't feel a need to add to it. But the minute it's going down or it declines, they feel, ooh, I'm losing money, so therefore let me buy some more. And when it does go back to the price I want it to go back at, because it's a really good share, allegedly, I'll win even more money. But actually what they're doing is compounding their losses. And it's more often than not, people are adding, the inexperienced people are adding as the share price is declining, right? Rather than adding when the share price is increasing.
Yeah. And, you know, it can work out. The averaging in sort of way of that would be, say, you know, you'd already work the risk out. It's dangerous when you're doubling up on your risk. So it's getting that heavy. If you were averaging in and you didn't care what price, you know, you're always going to be within your risk tolerance. Say I added 0.5% risk on account and then I added another 0.5%. It's always going to be 1% risk where I'm wrong. But, you know, the trouble is turns into a rescue mission, doesn't it? And it doubling up.
Yeah.
And on the other end of that is, you know, you know what I have to deal with is, you know, I can add to a stock and it can turn around and stop me out for a small loser from what looked like a pretty good 2R winner at the time. But I'm not shooting for, so I've got to be able to just, I've got to look at the portfolio and just go, I've got 16 stocks here. I have absolutely no, you know, I hate them all evenly is what I say. You know what I mean?
I
was riding JLP. It was a fantastic trade for me and I did fall in love with it. But still, I you know, when it stopped me out, it stopped me out, you know?
Yeah.
It goes back, Jay. I think the thing that you've, the word that you've not used, which must be explicitly said here, it's about you are disciplined. Yeah. You are disciplined. And I think, unfortunately, myself and many others are undisciplined and they're letting the market dictate sometimes what they do. And they're not behaving in a manner where they're in control of their own behaviours. They're letting the markets control their behaviours. And that's where losses occur. And that's where indiscipline causes people a lots of money. You know, it's about discipline, Jace.
Yeah, the first thing I teach people, and I get a lot of investors, and it's just how much heat have you got in the market? Where are you wrong? Do you know where you're wrong? Work it out. That little sum there, how much is it going to cost you where you think you're wrong on all stocks together if the market has a rug pull? That's how much it's going to cost you. Are you happy with that? And a lot of people will have double on what they think they're happy with, you know?
Yeah.
So, and it will probably come down to the just not position size right. The position size with the pound signs in their eyes. So they've had a bit more love for one stock. So they've gone heavier on the stock they really like. And they've gone lighter on the stock they don't really like. And what the market always does is the stock they think is more risky.
Yeah.
Turns out to be a huge multi-R trade. And the one what they think is fantastic does nothing or dives.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way I run my portfolio is every stock goes into that portfolio with exactly the same, weight. You know, weight. Risk of account, not the same weighting, but exactly the same risk. Some will be not really worth taking because they've got a really volatile base sometimes, but sometimes you go, well, there's not much reward to risk on that. And this is covered in the ShareScope tutorials that did as well. It's kind of in-depth stuff that I tried to do those tutorials to really make people think, but I get a lot of investors and they just go, oh my God, it's like light bulb moment, heat. So it's a very simple mathematical sort of, you know, there's a few parts to it. Knowing where you're wrong, knowing where you're long, position sizing for it, insulating the account with only, you know, if what your best ideas aren't working out and you're not managed to trail a trailing stock behind them and trail heat out of the market, you know, say you've got five great ideas and they don't do anything and the market's, you know, not bad. You've either got bad selection criteria or the market's just not ready for your stocks. You know, sometimes it's just not ready. And you have to just, you can't just keep throwing more mud at the wall, hoping some will stick, you know? If it's not working out, it's not working out. Throwing more heat or more risk at something what's already not working is not going to work in your favour.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a great example here, Jace. What my prime example is today, right? Indiscipline, right? So I purchased Loop Up, a stock that's been derided and loved and derided and loved by lots and lots of different people. And eventually today, I looked at the market, looked at what's going on, and I went, you know what? I'm done here now. So I got into it, and no one was like, I always go for stocks and look for stocks that no one's talking about. It's not on people's radar. So I was in it in October. So it's we're in the 4th of October. It's the 5th day of October, 2019. So exactly 2 years in the stock, right? Bought it just over 50p, right? I then trimmed it at 140 because I thought, you know what, it's getting a bit expensive. And then all of a sudden, every man and his dog was in the market, including Simon Thompson telling people that the stock was going to go to £3. Okay, so I trimmed it at 140 on the 25th of June, 2020. In the August, Simon Thompson's telling everybody it's going to £3. Then it has a profit warning and rolls over in the November 27th, and I'm thinking it's got to be a bargain now. It's gone. It's been tipped to go to £3. It's had a bit of a warning. It's at 80p. I'll buy some more, right? And then I'm looking at it again. It's just not doing anything at all. Market's not liking what's going on. They're talking about coming out of lockdown because it's a work from home stock, software stock. And I buy some more at 73 pence, 10% less than what I bought it at, almost 10% less than what I bought it in the November. And I buy it at 73 pence. And then it just goes lower and lower and lower. And I've had so many warnings, so many red flags on LoopUp as to, Pete, get out of the stock, get out of the stock, be disciplined, get out of the stock. I'm thinking, no, it's a software company. It's going to be, we're going to be working from home longer. We're going to get another lockdown later in the year, blah, blah, blah. COVID's not going away. Today I sold it at 25p. Right, just over 25 pence, and I've basically, for holding it for 2 years, right, basically about 2 or 3% up on the whole of that ride on that stock. Completely wasted my time with it, but I've learned stuff. I've learned a lot about it, and I've been thinking about this stock for a while now, and everything it speaks and screams is indiscipline regarding my approach to that particular stock, because I believed in what they were doing and I believed the management, but my mistake was, they did not execute, right? And I had opportunities to sell that at, you know, being disciplined, I would have sold out once it rolled back again to £1.40. But I didn't. I was buying at 80p instead. Just madness. And then you go back to where I bought it at 50p, just over 50p. Could have sold it there. Didn't. It's just so many wrongs there, you know. And I feel quite frustrated with myself, given the number of years I've been investing, to have made so many mistakes in just one stock. So, lessons to be learnt, mate.
Yeah, I'm just looking at that one. So, I presume, you know, obviously the turnover dropping off a cliff was a kind of a later thing, and that was a surprise to the market. I presume that's one of those gap downs, is it?
Yeah, that's one of them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of clever opinions on these things. You know, I forgot more than I know about this stuff. You can keep it really simple at the end of the day. I always, you know, if a stock's trading 52-week lows, you know, the bigger players that be want know a lot more than, you know, it's good for us to think that we can do research and know more than everyone. Sometimes I presume we can, you know, but, it, you know, is that a chance? I don't know. You know, can you repeat that? You know, that's going to be pretty tricky repeating it over and over again. But at the end of the day, if it starts trading 52-week lows, there's someone out there who knows more than we know.
Absolutely.
Because if the bigger players are accumulating something, they are not making, they hold it in the price action. They control the bases, the consolidations. So when you see the orderly consolidation, and the nice ones tend to get tighter in the right hand side. And, you know, I call it defined base, but everyone has their own name for it. You know, I know Mini Vinny's coined the term VCP. But at the end of the day, it's a defined base. They get tighter in the right-hand side. The buy and sell sort of pressure equalizes. And the institutions can just bounce them in that range until they've got their position. They can't have a stock breaking out with half their position in it. They can just tap the stock back down when they need to on very little pressure from the top of the breakout area until they've got their position. And then when it goes, you know, it's not going to be basing off 52-week lows is basically what I'm trying to say.
I knew that I was eventually going to say when you're going to get to the point. But, yeah, you're absolutely spot on. And this is the beauty, Jace, really, about the education side of it. I'm talking about people who've only been in the markets, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. And the thing I'm always saying on Twitter is that we're all learning. I think there's some people out there that think they've got nothing to learn. And even when they make a mistake, they don't hold a hand up. And I think the beauty of it is that I've learned over my near 30 years far more from my mistakes than anything that I've ever won or any stock that's done and been successful for me. And this is just another one of those lessons here for me. And you know, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, lesson learned, a lot of lessons learned, and I'll be better for it going forward. If you know, to see what I'm saying.
Yeah, what I've found, especially at trading bases, is someone who's got absolutely no knowledge of markets is going to be easier. It's going to be easier to get them to profitability fast.
Yeah, I can believe that.
The more time you fight with things, what you know, you can spend a lot of time learning, going down, and it will just be a blind alley. You know, you can think you've got something, and you'll get nowhere. And at the end of the day, it's a game of holding your winners, adding to what's working, cutting the losers, and having a very simple way. And that brings us around to stop losses. You know, extremely simple way of getting out of the market. And if you know where you're wrong before you get in, you've got a stop loss there. When that price is traded, the nice man in the stop loss machine will send that order to market as a market order, and you will get filled. Sometimes it will be with a bit of slippage. Sometimes it will be at a better price. The time it goes to market, you know, will dictate that. It is what it is, but that's where I'm wrong. And it's, you know, basically it's just an order. It's the best way to trade orders, you know, for entry, orders for exit, and not be there hovering over the fruit machine. Make very, very, very simple decisions before you take the trade, and
stick with it. Yeah.
And I have to go back a long time, but I do get reminded a lot of this sort of learn newbie things, trying to make the money back in the same stock,
revenge trading, mate.
Trying to, you know, you've got to be right. You know, I always say I have a pretty good idea which stock in the portfolio, you know, some of them just have the look, you know, WATR, the look, it had it. Yeah. You know, CER, it just had the look. It had really oddly, even though it was a liquid, really oddly price action. You know, that's what I love. And you know, it takes a lot of seat time to be able to sort of throw a bit more risk at something like that. But, you know, you've just got to remember there's a lot of clever people out there. They can talk very clever about this stuff, a lot cleverer than me. But actually, at the end of the day, it's a very simple thing what we have to do here. Very simple.
No, that's brilliant.
The simpler, the execution,
I'm conscious we've had you on here now for 50-odd minutes. I just wanted to just wrap up here. You do the articles on ShareScope, SharePad, and you also do the trading bases. Where can people find you regarding trading bases? What's the website?
Tradingbases.co.uk.
Yep. Jace, I think we're going to have you back, mate. And we've done this before with other people.
Definitely.
I think we've pretty just scratched the surface here regarding all the different elements to this. So I think that's what we're going to have to do going forward, mate. I'm conscious that we're already 66 minutes in. And if we carry on, there'll just be a two-hour marathon. But we're definitely going to have you back, mate. It's been absolutely brilliant and insightful. And I love the fact that you just speak it as it is rather than, you know, trying to just shoehorn lots of long words into it to make you sound even brighter than you are.
Yep, I don't have no magic for you. Just
Well, do you know, it's funny because I think there's so much magic in what you've just said. You know, the 3/4 an hour, whatever it is that you've been talking, I think it is absolutely ram with magic, and I just love the simplicity of what you do. And I've learned so much from you, Jason. So thank you, you know, hand on heart, thank you so much for what I've learned from you over the years. And it's just simple things like, you know, not averaging down. You know, if you've got a stock and it's going badly and you really can't bring yourself to sell it because you love it too much, whatever you do, don't buy more of the damn thing. You know, only buy more if it's formed a base and it's broken out and it's moving higher again, which could take, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years. But no, I mean, absolutely love it. I love the adding to winners. I think that's brilliant. I love the idea that you let the market decide what's a winner, not you. I just think that's excellent.
And I have no clue. No clue in my portfolio.
I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, we all
next time I'd love you to talk about your swing trading, because that's a bit I'd really be fascinated about.
Yeah, perfect. We all trade very different styles, and I always say it's not my way or the highway. I just try and bring it across from my point of view, you know.
Well, yeah. I love mixing styles. So, you know, I pinch ideas from you that I then melt into what I do, if you see what I mean. And it definitely helps. You know, stealing little bits from different people and getting your own sort of system is definitely the way to go.
Yeah, definitely. That's how I've sort of done it. Definitely.
Okie dokie, Jace. Thanks ever so much, mate. And we'll catch up soon. And good luck with finishing off that that surfing van, mate. Okay?
Thanks very much. Cheers, all.
Right, take
thanks,
care.
God bless, mate.
There you go, Pete. Another education there for you, me, and our listeners. What do you think of that, mate?
Oh, I love it. I mean, you know, when I didn't know who was going to be on the call until literally just before the call started when you told me. And as soon as I heard it was Jason, I was like, oh, brilliant, you know, because I've learned so much from the guy and it's so useful what he says and his simplicity in that is just brilliant.
Absolutely agree, mate. Absolutely agree. Mm-hmm. Right, we're going to go. We've got about 10, 15 minutes, Pete, and this is going to be one of the longest ones we've done for a little while. I quickly want to bring people up to speed with the Memphis fundraise.
Yeah.
And again, thank everybody that's donated so far. The last thing I've done regarding this Twin Peaks challenge is that we had one of our followers, a friend of one of our followers donated some England tickets to Wembley on the 12th. So that's next week, Wednesday, that is that game. And what I've done with those tickets, that I've added those to the Memphis Challenge with a view that people can win two tickets. So donate, retweet the tweet, donate a fiver. That closes tonight. Obviously, by the time we've published this, people won't be able to see that. But what's going to happen with that is that the monies is going to be added to the Twin Peaks Challenge. And that amount currently sits at £14,603.21 is what the total is at the minute. So we're inching towards the 15,000 goal that I've got for the Twin Peaks Challenge.
Awesome.
And I just wanted to read out two people here. We've had loads of other people that have donated recently, but there's a chap who basically has said, asked me to, I'm going to have to spell his name out. Is Vitam or Vitam Raw Schraff, and he's on Twitter, and he's put, good job, psychology, irrational behavior is every trader's downfall. I think that suits what I've just said about Loop Up. And then we've got Jay Hughes, and he's just saying, thank you for the hospitality on Friday the 17th of September regarding the Twin Peaks Challenge. That's the event that we had in Leicester. So he's donated, and so has Vitam. So I just wanted to thank everybody that's donated so far. And for those that have entered for the Memphis Wembley tickets, we'll be pulling out the winner tomorrow afternoon. It closes tonight. So by Friday, we'll have declared the winner for that. So we'll just keep inching towards. And if you haven't done so yet, and you've enjoyed one, or even more than one of these Twin Peaks podcasts, please, please, please consider making a donation to the justgiving.com/fundraising/Twin Peaks Challenge page. Thank you ever so much, people. Take care. God bless. Pete, let's talk some stocks, mate. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. Okay. I want to throw in a concept, really, and it's one about, you know, I'm always looking for small cap stocks that have got a big pile of cash. That always has me interested. And I'm going to talk about a couple quickly that I actually hold, which I hate doing because I don't want to, you know, I don't want this our podcast to ever be like a ramp fest, like, you know, we see so many places.
Okay, but, if that is the case, can we just have one and one that you don't
well,
own?
Well, no, it's more a concept. So what I'm going to say is that I noticed today a lot of talk on Twitter about SCS, you know, the sofa people. And there were comments sort of saying that, you know, it's like the market cap of the company, which is something like, say, 110 million, is covered by the cash, which is something like 87 million or whatever it is. And I thought, oh, blimey, that is a lot of cash. It's like you're getting the business for nothing. I must look into this and find out what's really going on. And I had my suspicion, you know, because when that cash is so high as a proportion of the market cap, you've got to wonder why. You know, the market's not totally stupid. Someone should have noticed that's an anomaly. Do you know what I mean? So I thought, I've got to look into this and figure it out. So before
it's customers' money that they're holding before the people get the sofas. Surely, everyone should know this. Come on.
You're exactly right. And so I went down into the balance sheet and dug into it. And there's a huge amount that is customer deposits. So it's not really the company's money. And just to relate that to two stocks that I hold, Air, which is Air Partner, that's a similar situation. They say we've got like a load of cash, but you've got to remember that a load of that cash is actually from the jet cards, which is where people do a prepayment and they're effectively paying for private jet flights in advance. I mean, yeah. AIR does have some cash, which is great, and it's a good company, but you know, just to be clear. The other one that I wanted to bring up is BAR, Brand Architects. That has got a lot of cash. I can't remember what the numbers are. People will have to go away and look for themselves. But they've got a nice big chunk of cash, and it's a big proportion of the market capitalization. They had a trading update the other day, or they had results or whatever. I think it was last week. And basically what they said there was that, you know, the results weren't that amazing. And on the actual day of the results coming out, the shares were down like 7.5% in the morning. But by the close, they'd actually recovered. And I got a feeling there was some director buying the next day, which I think was actually the CFO. I may be wrong, but I think there was. But the interesting thing was, is that even though the numbers weren't particularly stunning, the interesting thing was that BAR have done a heck of a lot in this sort of yearly period of rationalizing the brands. So they've really cut down the number of brands they have and the number of products they have, and they're getting much more focused. They've put a load of investment into their website stuff and into the online presence, and just don't, you know, people can read through the update, but they can see that there's a lot of operational stuff that they're really doing good work on. And I think that will set them up going forward. So it's certainly an interesting stock, and I'm very, very happy to be holding it.
Okay, cool. I suppose I wanted to bring everyone up to speed here with regards, if they're not aware already, that it looks like CD&R have concluded and purchased Morrisons. They went into auction, having bidded 285 against Fortress. They went into an auction, blind auction, and ended up being closed at 287. I'd sold, including dividend, at just over 296. And of course, after Saturday, the stock rolled back from 296 to towards 287, 285. So that's concluded. And I suppose the other stuff that I wanted to talk about is just to keep an eye on. Pete and I have been talking about supply chain issues and shortages for this and shortages for that. There's going to be more and more profit warnings coming down the pipe. It's not just inflation, but these supply chain issues.
Are you looking over my shoulder? On my list of crib notes that I always do before the podcast, I've got big stars around the words, warnings are back.
Yeah, I'm not looking over your shoulders, Pete, and I can't see that far down to Windsor. I'm still in Leicestershire.
That's incredible.
I think it's just people have to be mindful. We've been talking about this for months and months and months now, but we've got even more problems coming down regarding energy stuff and the cost of fuel and people having to pay more for their workers, etc., 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 etc. So I suspect over the next 2 or 3 months, you're going to have to look through your folder and look through your portfolios at the stocks you're holding. And be prepared, or start taking some stuff off that you don't have conviction in, because some of the stuff, I don't know, we're gonna get some things and they're gonna go, I didn't expect that from that stock. But there's different things impacting these stocks at the minute that weren't impacting them last year, and the things that they went through regarding lockdown and COVID and so on and so forth are different now. And everyone's waiting for October to pass to get to November, and or we're going to have a Christmas rally. We may well have a really good next 2 or 3 months, but be prepared that it may not be that case. Be prepared.
Boy Scouts, Girl Guides, all that stuff.
Absolutely. So, Pete, anything else you want to add?
I'll tell you what, mate, I've got a question for you, right? Today, there was a trading update or results or something for BSIF. So So I think it's like, I don't know, blue something solar fund, whatever it is. The thing that I noticed on that one is it's paying 6.5% dividend. Now, what gets me with, like, you know, these solar companies and whatever is that a lot of them are very much reliant on government subsidies and things. And I don't know if that's the case with BSIF, and that's obviously something that people need to look at. I don't hold it. But the other thing is, you know, I wonder with some of these things, like, they have, like, say, a 20-year lease on a wind farm. So that sort of implies that after 20 years, they don't actually own it or whatever. And I sort of, I'm not sure how the mechanism of that works. Have you ever come across that? Have you any ideas?
I don't know much about, I think the full name you're looking for is Bluefield Solar Income Fund, Pete. Looking at it quickly now. It's got a NAV of just under 116.
That's the net asset value, yeah.
Yeah, it pays a dividend. It's one of them things, Pete, that you've got to do more research on to find out exactly what's going on regarding that, because there's far more moving parts than just the leases. And we're in a situation now where we're talking about the energy problem and all the rest of it. And I think some of these companies are going to do well because of this particular situation. I've already bought an infrastructure fund, infrastructure exposed sort of entity for this particular reason. And I'm just keeping stum on it for now. It's going to be very interesting times because a lot of the peripheral companies that are in the energy market are going to get absolutely cream crackered and be taken out. And the big four are going to do well, but I think some of the other entities are going to do well going forward. And maybe BSIF will do okay. It's paying a nice dividend. You don't need much to compound 10% per year. I'll just have a quick look at what it's done so far this year, Pete. One second. At the minute, it's year to date, it's down 6%. And over 1 year, it's down 7%, but it's currently trading above NAV. So whether or not it'll do better in the next couple of months, I don't know. But given what's happened to some of the darlings on the stock market, it's outperforming many of those that have been ramped to high heaven. So, you know, if you're looking for preserving your capital, it's probably not a bad place to claim a good percentage of dividend.
Well, I'm thinking that you know, I'm sort of interested for my income portfolio to have something that's a little bit green, you know, and I'm sort of thinking, well, maybe BSIF, or there's several others, you know, the wind farm ones, and there's Grid, GRID, which is the battery one. And I'm thinking, you know, something like that, just to give it a bit of green flavor. But I realize that for my income portfolio, we're just talking about, we're talking about the plodders. It's the ones that, you know, Jason in the discussion earlier would call sloths. You know, the sloths are just like income payers that just really don't do much. But they're a nice thing to tuck away in an income portfolio where you're sort of after much lower returns.
Yeah, they're looking to pay a target price of 8p per share each year. So if they can manage that, you're doing okay. You're not looking for much to compound, as I say, your 10% per year. So yeah, it could be a good little income thing for you, you know, add to your CAGR, mate. So you never know.
Yeah, I need to look into it, because, like,
yeah, definitely look into it a bit more. You need to have a look at what the portfolio consists of, Pete, you know, and how diverse it is, and what countries they're actually exposed to, and what different projects they're involved in. You know what I mean? So, you know, that's what it's all about, really. Where is the portfolio? What's it involved in? And what longevity has it got? And how much money do they need to raise going forward? Or how much money have they got to continue to invest?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okie dokie, mate. We're on 1 hour and 22. So my apologies for those that are listening in one go here for this podcast. And for those that are listening in two bites, well, thank you for persisting with us. I want to say thank you ever so much to everyone again for your fantastic feedback regarding podcast 58. This was podcast 59, and we're heading towards number 60 in 2 weeks. So thank you ever so much for that. And thank you also for just keep persisting with us and giving us the feedback, because Pete and I are always looking to improve this. So some of the comments that we've had have helped us, and Pete and I have some discussions about how we can improve things and what things we need to discuss. So I just want to thank you all for continuing to support us. We're really pleased that you've enjoyed the guests that we've had on in the past, and we hope that you enjoy this podcast here with Jace at StealthServe from Trading Bases. And if you do, please share your feedback. If you don't, please share your feedback, and we'll continue to bring you some further guests going forward. For now, take care, God bless, and look after yourself, and look after yourself, and look after yourselves, and look out for others and show kindness. Take care, God bless.
See ya.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScoop, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScoop.co.uk and discover the advantage.